This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
Hi, this is Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak. We're having a little technical difficulty here, but I think I've got Admiral Moran on with us. Admiral Moran, are you there tonight?
I am up. Yes, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Sorry, Sal is having a little trouble down his location, so it may be you and me for a minute until I get him on board. We'll skip the standard introduction. Oh, here we go. Well, he's come. Here he comes. All right, Sal, you're with us now, Sal. And for those of you who have joined us on Midrats, our guest today is Vice Admiral Moran, Chief of Naval Personnel. Should be an interesting show, and why don't we get started with some questions? Admiral, we've had you on before, so I think you're pretty familiar with the format, but there's been a lot of naval personnel issues in the news lately, at least in the news that the naval officers follow. How closely do you follow some of these controversies that arise on junior officers announcing their intention to resign and things like that? Is that a hot-button issue for you in your job?
In my world of anti-submarine warfare, I'd call it ambient noise. I mean, I listen to it, but I'm looking for the strong signal that comes out of it, if you will. So yeah, I pay attention to it. There are a lot of young lieutenants and enlisted folks that get right in and actually come to me directly at times. So I do pay attention to it because I think the dialogue is important and the discourse is important as we're all trying to learn how to take the Navy forward.
Yeah, Vice Admiral Moran, Sal here, and I like the way you put it. It is ambient noise there in the background, and it's funny, some of the things that have floated up recently when I was reading it. I actually wrote my first letter of resignation back in 1994, and it looked very familiar. I think a lot of those issues are transgenerational. But one thing that definitely I know breaks above your background noise and does everybody else is everybody has a boss, even vice admirals, and vice admirals' bosses have bosses. And we have a new SecDef, and SecDef Ash Carter, he's made some comments recently about his thoughts, really DOD-wide, about the larger personnel policy that we have and some ideas that we can do to perhaps move the needle in a positive direction for the DOD, and of course that trickles down to the Navy. What is some of the direction and guidance you've seen as the Chief of Naval Personnel coming from on high with the new Secretary of Defense do you think will require the most attention from the Navy side of the house? It may impact sailors more than perhaps some of the other broader issues he's brought up.
Yeah, Sal, it's music to my ears to hear senior leadership talking about this. As you know, we've been working on several aspects of trying to modernize the way we manage people for the last 18 months, and to have a new secretary come in and actually nominate a new PNR, Personnel and Readiness, at OSD, both of whom have some pretty strong thoughts about how to take on some of the structural problems with the way a personnel system has been built over the last 50, 60 years. It's time to take a different look and a different view of how to do that. So they've challenged the OSD level folks to form some working groups and to put some structure into the debate. Of course, I think it's also tied, and it should be tied, to the commission's report on the retirement and other pay and compensation issues that are out there. And I think it's very helpful to the initiatives we've got underway already. And we, when I say we, I mean SecNav has been very strong on using some innovative ideas here to change the way we manage folks. So I'm pretty energized by it. My team's energized by it. And I think it it puts some validity into the discourse and a conversation we've had with junior officers and junior sailors for the last 18 months.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those innovations. What do you see coming down the road that our young people, both enlisted and officer, can look at and say, the Navy's really changing, and I've got some opportunities in front of me?
Yeah, there are several policy issues that, when I say policy, that those are things that are within the Secretary of the Navy's and the Chief of Naval Operations and my purview to change if we want to. When I talk about statute of law, of course, that means Title 10, DOTMA reform, those sorts of things. And we're trying to focus right now, near term, on things that we think we can change in policy that are linked to some basic fundamentals. I'll start with trying to give more power and more authority back to COs at the 05 level or across the fleet. What things in policy can we do to make sure that they've got the authorities they need to recognize and move along young men and women with the right skill sets and talent to take the long view in the Navy? And then there are several things in the world of how we train that is, in my view, very closely linked to personnel management, and that's how we train young men and women, especially in the enlisted force. I mean, you guys have been around long enough to know that in the officer communities, if you rotate between assignments, especially going from shore duty back to sea in whatever platform you're in, we're going to send you back to some schoolhouse, some training program to make sure that you've got the latest and greatest in TTPs and new equipment. You might even be changing platforms for all you know. And we want to make sure you're ready so when you walk in the door, you can start being a productive leader in that community. On the enlisted side, we generally give all that training right out of boot camp through A schools and C schools. There are some exceptions to that, but of the 90-plus ratings in the Navy, the vast majority of them get all their training up front when they're 18, 19 years old. Some of that training lasts 2 years, but most of it's in the 6 months to a year long. You could argue that an 18-year, 19-year-old is going to have a lot of retention issues when it comes to retaining information and whether they're really learning that material or if they're just being made aware of that. So I believe we as a Navy need to change our enlisted training platforms to come closer to what we do for officers. I think it'll motivate them. It'll inspire them more. I think good sailors, really good sailors, will appreciate the fact that they're getting the training at the right time as opposed to all at once. And then lastly is the notion that we have a lot of great aspects of the Navy culture that we all want to keep. There's a lot of great tradition in the Navy. The things we love about serving are things we want to preserve, and we want to do everything we can to continue that tradition in the way we educate young men and women, get them to grad school, those who really want to do it, and have the proven performance to do it. So there's so much here to talk about. I could eat up the whole hour without pausing. So let me stop there for a minute, and then if you want to get into more specifics, I can tell you about legislative proposals we've got on the books, and I can tell you about some policies that my team in Millington is actively going forward with to try to do what I just described in theory. Over.
Oh, what's great is you have embedded in your answer right there, you have tee up for three questions. I want to control myself and just focus one question at a time. Just like you outlined. And one of the great tee-ups is, it was very interesting, earlier this year, I had the opportunity to go over to AFSEA, USNI's conference over on West in San Diego, and that's a very technical conference, as I'm sure you know. All the equipments are there, everybody's wanting to show their new whiz-bang stuff. And one of the nicer things that was there is they brought in Hilo static display all kitted out, and they also brought in some of the riverine guys, and they were there during the course of the conference and were talking to people. And I went over, it's kind of a technical conference with all the various people selling their wares, And so I went over and I talked to the crews at both the Hilo and the Riverine guys, and I kind of teed up what I thought would be a pretty straightforward question, but I got very interesting answers instead. It's a standard question after, hello, how you doing, the pleasantries. I asked them what, because they both had new equipment, nice equipment, relatively speaking. And I said, you know, what kit do you have on board here that you don't have that you really wish that you had that would make your mission and those of your sailors go better? And interesting, both responses that I got that were most direct to the questions didn't even answer the question, but they went in another direction. One answer I got was one of the JOs, he looked at me and he said, well, what I would really like is, like, I love my kit. It's all great here. It works great. We're able to accomplish what we want to accomplish. But, you know, here I am coming up on shore duty, and I'm looking to maybe make a career, and everybody's telling me that I cannot make a career or spend more of my career in the small Navy with small ships, that I've got to go big, I've got to go do all these hurdles. He said, I'm not interested in that. I would like to be able to have an option that somebody could tell me that if I wanted to stay small Navy, that I would have a way that I could compete for those jobs and try to control my career in that respect. And the other answer tied into something you brought about training our sailors, and I know that we've all been there in the course of our career, is another really straightforward answer I got that doesn't answer my question, is he said, what I would really like is when I have a billet open for an EN1, I have an EN1 leaving, he's fully qualified, he knows our equipment, we have some specialty equipment that he works with, that his replacement shows up and has gotten the training before he shows up, because we've lost a talented EN1. Now we have another EN1 that's come in who's almost no use to us, and so we have this gap to billet while he goes off and gets specialized training. So boil that down into two areas. One's, you know, officer career path and perhaps how we're doing the technical training with our enlisted personnel. Are we looking at giving officers the ability to compete for jobs if they wanted to regardless of what the longer-term career implications may be for them, to be able to do that? And on the enlisted side of the house, what type of feedback mechanism do we have in place for commands that they can push up the chain, the fact that this problem still is not being fixed, and when you're in small commands, that has a big impact on people's ability to make mission?
Yeah, Sal, it's a mouthful. Let me try to answer it. The flexibility that we're trying to build into a modernized system, if you will, for both officers and enlisted, is already being addressed somewhat with billet-based detailing. And in my world, that is basically identifying in every billet across the officer and enlisted communities the skill sets, the experience levels, the pay grades that every billet in the Navy demands. We do that somewhat with officers today, but we have not done that with the enlisted force forever. And there's been an effort to build this BBD system for at least a couple years, if not longer. It's been in work for a while, and a lot of great work being done there. That will make it easier for the detailers and the system that allows enlisted young men and women, along with their career counselors and chain of command, to look and see where those opportunities are further out and to see if their skill sets more precisely match their talents. That's coming out here in later this fall, early next year, and everyone we've briefed that is involved in manpower is really looking forward to that. So that'll help us tighten that up a bit. But we still could do more along those lines. On the officer side, if you don't address the career paths and the things and the requirements that really restrict young officers from being able to stay on a path to next key milestones within their warfare community, it's going to be very, very difficult to do the kinds of things that young officer is talking to you about. So we are trying to clean up our system so that the data that we have, which is all over the place, it allows us at the detailer level, the commanding officer level, the individual sailor officer level, everybody will have a similar picture to be able to see what the opportunities are and where they are and whether they can apply for those kind of jobs you're talking about. One of the interesting things that has come up recently is probing by the Hill, especially Senator McCain, who's the chairman of the SASC, has asked for some ideas about should we, could we, must we look relook at Goldwater Nichols, which drives a lot of our joint requirements, and our detailers are trying to get everybody that wants to make it a career in the Navy JPME, so all the education for Phase 1 and 2 and a joint tour, and stay on track to their community milestone events. That makes it really tough in some communities because of the length of training tracks and a bunch of other things. So several of the initiatives we've got in place here are to allow us to build in more flexibility in that career path for those who, through no fault of their own or by personal desire, want to take a different path for a while but are still extremely competent, very talented, and we want to see them stay longer in the Navy. We give them a flexible option to go to grad school, to take a different path to enhance their skill sets, and then bring them back and do things like resetting their lineal number instead of tying them to their year groups, and they march along at the same pace, if that makes sense. So that, hopefully that answers both of your questions, and I'll go into any greater detail you want there.
Yeah, that's a really interesting approach that I hadn't. One of the questions I had written down here was, how do we keep good people who are doing good work, and or do we have to force them out on that upper out system? And it sounds like you all are discussing at the highest levels an approach that would allow somebody who really likes, as Sal said, being in the riverine force, to stay in that, and yet not necessarily have it count against wickets he could have. Could have, should have had, and if he'd gone back to the larger surface force, is that a correct assessment on my part?
Yeah, so that's part of it. I mean, you all know, and everybody listening knows that the Navy's got to distribute people where the Navy needs them. So the needs of the Navy oftentimes trump everything because we don't have billets everywhere where everybody always wants to go. On the other hand, we've got a lot of places where people go kicking and screaming, and when they get there, they are kicking and screaming when they are told it's time to go. And Riverine's one of them. A lot of sailors go in the Riverine community, and they just love the work, and they want to stay. But there's also a large number of people who want to get into Riverine. So you've got to create flow. But you could argue that one of the challenges that we have is where we have really attractive communities, we may have too many people that are trying to go in that community, and so we could potentially, if we can retain sailors longer in that community at certain pay grades with a different type of compensation system and keep them happy there, that we don't have to train and bring in as many people to do that same job. So there's a cost savings to doing that. So all of that stuff's being built in we're trying to build it into policies that allow us to be more flexible and not to have a system that automatically is trying to move people every 2 to 3 years.
The concept of taking some time out, taking a few years, whether it's through the grad school or something like that, I was curious how we've looked at people who may have made that decision, they decided to make that call. In the course of our reference point, we've all seen situations where the demands of year groups can change a lot in the course of 2 or 3 years, and sometimes dramatically. Back in the 90s, we had the whole T-notch problem. Has it looked at somebody who decides, if we have the program in place, that they want to take 2 or 3 years off and come back? And what happens in the course of that time, if they are we looking at small enough numbers that it really won't impact select groups or year groups? Or what if we're in a situation where we, for budgetary or policy reasons, whatever, they want to come back in a year that we're having to reduce people a lot? Nothing in life is guaranteed. But what have we looked at in potential, downside to this program to make sure that people fully aware of what may or may not be available for them when they come back?
Yeah, it's a profound question that has to be red-teamed and red-celled as we build in these things. So one of the things we're very careful about as we look for changes to policy, that they become discretionary and not mandatory. So it allows you to, depending on the circumstances, to your example of when we may be in a downsizing mode, to make sure that we don't have inadvertent consequences or unintended consequences to really talented folks trying to come back in that example. I think the risk is greater in a stable environment or even a growth environment, that if we don't build in some of that flexibility, we won't be able to grow the force with the right quality when we're in a challenging economic time. So the projections for the Navy over the next 5 years are very stable, if not a little bit of a growth period. And if the economy starts to pick up steam, and there are some signs, although every day is different when you look at the indices, that there may be an opportunity here for the economy to build some strength, and the market that normally drives some of our folks out will begin to pick up. And when that happens, what flexible options do we have at our hands and at our disposal to entice our best to stay in? Today, and what we've used in the last, well, since I've been in the Navy, are monetary incentives. Those are the only policies and tools we have in place at the macro level. So we cast a wide net when we use those fiscal bonus incentives. We're not precise. We're not surgical, and we don't give any. We really don't give any of that authority to COs who are there eyeball to eyeball with these young men and women trying to make those decisions. So I want to push that down as far as we can to let the COs have the greatest vote in that decision, because they're having a personal conversation with the sailors that are working for them.
One of the aspects of that, I guess, that is important in that, it would seem to me, is to have a pretty good IT infrastructure to allow everybody to, you know, I hate the word transparency, but I'm going to use it now, to have some transparency into what's going on. Are there steps being taken to upgrade the Navy's personnel IT stuff?
Yeah, Eagle One, this is probably the, I call it the critical path to be able to execute what I just described. We do not have the vehicles in place, the IT systems in place that allow us to move quickly and make decisions based on real-time data. Much of it's in hindsight and rolled up weeks and months after the fact. And that's why you may remember the first time I talked to you, probably 18 months ago, my biggest fear was swinging behind the pitch in this job. Most of that is because we have a difficult time in our analytics capability of forecasting and predicting. And there will be several people out there who will argue that, well, it's really hard to forecast and predict human behavior and economics. But we could do better than we are doing today. I'd venture to guess every former CNP, and certainly everyone I've talked to, and I've talked to several, wish they had a more flexible and responsive analytic capability. And most of that is because we build functional capability in personnel to deal with an aspect of detailing, distribution, pay, compensation, bonuses. And inside those functions, we build our own database and our own system. And over time, that just builds to today, we have about 40 different functional systems, each with their own database, and several that don't talk to each other. And so that makes it really, really challenging. So we are on a path right now to take those 40 different databases, let's call it that, and clean it all up and put it into one authoritative database. That's our term for very clean data across all the different functions in personnel and pay. When we achieve that, and we're going to do that within the next couple of years, we'll be able to now plug in applications, much like you do on your smartphones today and your PDA devices, that allow us to reach into that data real time, probe it, get information, ask questions, do queries, and be able to pull it real time. and be able to do that at multiple tiers. My level, certainly at the ISIC level or the TICOM level, all the way down to the commanding officer and sailor level. They'll have a common picture to make decisions about data. That transparency is absolutely important if we're going to move the force forward, because that's what, it's not just millennials, but that's what you and I expect today when we go online or we pull up data on our smartphones. We expect that information to be there, and it's very frustrating for all of us today that it's not available and that you don't have to log in 5 or 6 different ways on multiple systems to try to correlate information. That's what we have today. We're going to change that in the next couple of years.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, Vice Admiral Moran, that's not strictly a Navy problem. My paying gig now that I'm a civilian, we also are having the problem with things that in theory are supposed to be supporting systems and supporting infrastructure. After a while, they can become the supported. And I like the term you use, swinging behind the pitch. And all these metrics and supporting systems that are supposed to be in place, you know, that's one challenge that you have, trying to get a clear and accurate view of exactly where you are now so you can plan for the future. But there's also, especially in personnel policy, there's also a regulatory and even a political aspect that can further, you know, provide restraints and constraints on what you can do or where you can really get some positive momentum with effort you do put forward there. And as the economy heats up, and we've all seen these cycles before again, sometimes you can get an idea of what particular specialties will become easily seduced by the civilian side, and you have to be able to maneuver as that takes place. How nimble is the naval personnel system with its bonuses and its incentives to be able to, assuming you can see these shortages and these challenges coming up, to be able to move and adjust and apply pressures to try to mitigate any shortfalls that might take place? Or do we have a system that not just from the whether the computer or the metric side of the house, but also from the regulatory political side of the house, that just slows us down in a negative way?
Yeah, I would describe it, I tried to describe it a couple weeks ago at Sierra Space, and I basically boiled down to it stinks. We really do have a system that is got a lot of great functionality in stovepipes, but what we need to do is integrate those across, and that's the work to be done. And I think when we get there, then we will reach a more agile and flexible system that will provide us the transparency that Eagle One mentioned. We've got to get there. Otherwise, we're going to continue to cast wide policy nets to try to capture a quantity. I often say that I can get you quantity all day long. We can always man the Navy with numbers. But what's more important to COs and sailors and all of us is that we capture the right quality within that quantity. And that's the part where a better information system, a better IT system will help our detailers, help our commanding officers, and help all of us that are trying to set pretty precise policy to be able to affect that down the road. We're not there right now.
As if you didn't have enough other issues on your plate, I have a question about comments that get made predicting the future of the Navy and how that if it affects recruiting and the positions you end up having your people take. Let's say, for example, the recent comments that the F-35 may be our last manned aircraft. Down the road, are people paying attention to that so that it would be harder to recruit young officers to become pilots? Or do you see, and that's just an example, but do you see cases where sometimes comments about where we're headed have an impact on who we get to join the Navy?
I mean, I'm familiar with the comment you're referring to on F-35. I think it's way too early to tell, but there's no question that young men and women that go to air shows and watch what our pilots do, whether it's in the Blues or other air shows, or watch films or watch some of our advertising, want to imagine themselves in those cockpits. They want to imagine themselves in those units. And so we got to be real careful that we don't disconnect their dreams and aspirations from reality and what they're hearing about what could be the future. That's a much, much different future. But I think when you look at how long we're going to be flying, even if it's F-35, we're going to be buying F-35 well into the 40s. So we're quite a ways away from that future. But your point's well taken, and we do have to, my biggest job is making sure we're recruiting the right base for the future of the Navy. And in today's social media environment, you could argue that our best recruiters are those who are serving today or have served. So veterans and active duty sailors are talking to future Navy sailors. And if that debate starts to rage about, we're not going to have pilots in the future, we got to make sure we put it in the right context. That future is a long ways away, but I think it's way too early to make that an absolute, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I understand exactly, and I guess one of the questions behind all that is, to the extent that it does, to if we have a strategic plan that submarines will be a primary system, for example, does that impact on how, in terms of a strategy, does that impact the way we recruit people and the kinds of people that we try and retain in the service?
I haven't felt that yet, Eagle One. Most of our efforts in the recruiting force are really trying to find kids that are propensed to serve. And they'll serve in many different forms, to include young men and women who are thinking about being officers as well as our young enlisted sailors. So it's that most 18 and 19 year olds are looking at an opportunity to serve, and while they have some skill sets they think are things they want to build off of, I for one did not join the Navy thinking I was going to fly someday. It grew on me as I became familiar, but I know several of my friends who wanted nothing but flying off the front end of a carrier. And so you get a mix of everybody, and I'm not worried about it yet, but again, your point's well taken about making sure we've got a strategy to address that as these programs come out and we start talking about them in greater detail.
Sal's still having some technical issues. I've got him live, but I think he missed the last question. When you talked about efforts at Millington that were underway, could you kind of discuss those? You invited us, I think, to ask about that.
Yeah, well, my wonderful team down there, led by Dave Steindl and Annie Andrews and several others, they've got at least almost 70 different initiatives that they're working on right now. Putting detail behind them, doing red selling, red teaming, trying to understand the impacts. But these are all initiatives we think do build in greater flexibility, greater choice for our sailors. They do go after that IT system I talked about, and most of our functional systems are in Millington, Tennessee. They do go after some of the cultural, enriching cultural initiatives that we're trying to put in place. And we work hard with organizations like CNIC and the base support structure to expand gym hours, fitness hours. Just things you would otherwise take for granted are things that you have to consciously and explicitly go after to continue to attract young men and women who have families, who are single sailors, and many of whom are outstanding sailors. You want to do everything you can to give them a chance to make the Navy a career and not have to make an in or out choice at different stages of their career. So those things, along with specific legislative proposals that are targeted at potentially changing the statutes which govern how we are able to manage officers, for example. We've got a legislative proposal on Capitol Hill right now, which which basically takes the career intermission program and expands it to allow more people to be eligible for it. Today, if you're under your minimum service requirement, or what most folks that are on active duty understand as MSR, which is generally 5 years after graduation, you're not eligible for CIP. If you're on a critical skills retention bonus, you're not eligible for CIP. And we're limited to just 40 a year for a very large Navy. So the ledge prop that's over there right now opens the aperture on all three of those provisions, and it's got a lot of great support, and we hope Congress signs it because it'll allow us to deal with some pretty unique situations. Then there's a whole series of other legislative proposals, which really, if I could wrap them up into one way to describe them, it blurs the lines, if not erases the lines, of year group management in the officer communities, and by extension, the enlisted force. And there are a lot of people who have been longtime personnel folks will get a little nervous about that. But I think if you combine the efforts we're making in having more available information readily available and is more agile and precise, we can manage our way through this and at the same time provide flexible options to really talented folks who want to make the Navy a career. Over.
Yeah, this... This is kind of a tough subject I wanted to bring up, but it's mostly tough because I know anybody in a leadership position, it's really tough when you see somebody through no fault of their own is in a position where, and a lot of these people are sailors that would do anything for you. They'll go on sea duty back to back, but they're just were born a certain way. That they found themselves in a bureaucratic corner, and specifically what we're talking about is the infamous body composition assessment, how we look at people and grab the tape and determine whether somebody's in standard and out of standards. And many times you see people, they're top shelf sailors, they look incredibly physically fit, a lot of them look like MMA people, but they're being told that they're outside of standards. Whereas you have people who are inside of standards that, if we're looking about physical ability, are a shadow of these individuals that are finding themselves in trouble. I know this is a topic that you've looked at. If you could talk for a bit about what are some potential changes we could be seeing down the road that might get us a little bit closer to a system that better supports not only the needs of the Navy, but also is able to help those sailors who do want to serve, but just genetically were born with a certain body shape.
Yeah, Sal, I run into this everywhere I go in a fleet. It usually goes one of two ways. A sailor will stand up who looks like the model poster for a sailor, and he or she will stand up and say, "When am I going to get more advancement points for having outstanding on the PRT?" They want more, they want it tougher, and then they want to excel. And then almost always there's the counter proposal from a sailor who stands up, and he or she is more boxed shape, to your point, has broad shoulders and pretty bulky, but looks pretty sharp in uniform. And they'll raise their hand and say, you know, I'm not able to take the PRT, the physical readiness test, because I can't get inside the BCA limits, the body composition assessment. And you know that's happening in places around the fleet. So the CNO's heard this when he goes out, the secretary's heard this, MCPON's heard it, and I've heard it enough that told CNO and the secretary that we're going to go take it on. Long overdue. One of the things we've learned is there's no medical rationale for the BCA measurements in terms of health. What it comes down to is how sharp do you look in uniform? And the BCA seems to be the only measure by which we've used to determine how sharp you look in uniform. But it's also become a default setting for whether we think you're healthy or not. So if you don't pass the BCA standard, you can't even take the PRT, which seems a little counterintuitive to most of us. So what we're trying to do is separate that body fat assessment, that body composition assessment, from health. And so we're asking more from the medical community to look at actual health indicators and determining and helping sailors go on a more healthy course of action to make sure that they're living healthier lives and can live longer lives, and then drive down the cost of medical care for the Navy down the road. So that's everything from taking blood to assessing their blood pressure and any number of things that aviators get to do every year, but sailors do not. So that's the healthy side of things. Then we want to do things that incentivize better health. Use the actual physical readiness test, the PRT, to see whether they've got good cardiovascular health, and if they don't, to put them on the FEP program to help them get healthier. Disconnect that from, do they look sharp in uniform? And if they don't, then we're gonna help them, give them an opportunity to get to look sharper in uniform, or they're going to be asked to leave, much like we do today, but we use it with the BCA measurement. So it's healthier, incentives for healthier, and then looking sharp, being professional in uniform. Those two things today are all rolled up underneath the physical readiness program, and I would like to see them broken apart a little bit so that we're actually taking care of sailors to help them be healthier, and at the same time make sure that we have folks that look sharp in uniform. So those are the two components of what we're addressing right now, and we're pretty close to taking this a proposal to CNO and then the Secretary within the next month or so. Does that help you?
Yes, sir.
You ready to come back on active duty and take that test?
I still have my girlish figure. I might have to work on my push-ups a little bit, though.
But, hey, you know, I'll use myself as an example because I think it helps people. So I'm a little over 6 foot, and I've got to be under 206 pounds to meet the height weight standards and not have to be taped. By more often than not, a young E5 or an E6 who doesn't want to be there taping a senior flag officer, no matter how you look at it. And then I have to get inside a BCA limit of body composition of 26%, I think it is. I'm sorry, 23%. Now, that has no bearing on how healthy I am. And it has no bearing on how well I can take the test. And it has no bearing on age. I mean, the age calculations and differences stop at age 40, so everybody over on the same thing. And we all know that we change as we get older. So, interestingly enough, the Army has a different, I would say, a more lenient BCA measurement than we do. The Marines, of course, are at the other end of the spectrum. So I'm just looking for balance, I'm looking for common sense, and I'm looking for really motivated, sharp, good sailors that look sharp in uniform to make sure that this is not getting in the way of them continuing service. Over.
Well, I hope you have a different standard for people over 60, Admiral, because if you're going to bring me back, I'm afraid that what a 18-year-old sailor and I have in common is probably we have both, you know, two arms and two legs.
Amen. I'm getting close, though.
One of the other things that seems to bother young officers is the system of force ranking. And I hate to almost use this, but, you know, where some officer has got to be number one, and if you have a wardroom that's any good, you may have five really outstanding officers, but you've got to find ways to creatively rank them to keep them competitive for promotion. Is part of the new look you're taking at this stuff a way for the 05s and 06s to work around that a little more easily?
Well, I think if we get the electronic and the IT system where we want it, there's an opportunity to change the way we conduct performance evaluations. It's pretty cumbersome today. It is a force distribution that was necessary to try to shape the force. And so we are, it's, we're not actively working this one right now, but we will in the future. We're talking to a lot of industries. We've talked to all the other service counterparts. Everybody does it differently. And it's funny. I look at the Marine Corps model and I go, well, that's pretty good. They're pretty honest and direct. And they look at our model and some of them go, boy, I wish we had your system. So no, everybody's child isn't as pretty as they'd like it to be. And they kind of like the other child better in some cases. So we're trying to figure out what's the best way to go at this. A lot of emphasis in the last few years about 360 evaluations, getting direct feedback from subordinates and peers. There's some value, of course, in doing that, and we've seen that value with leadership courses up in Newport. We've seen that value in some training environments. But to institutionalize that across the force is a pretty tough thing to do. 360s are not inexpensive, and they're pretty time-consuming, and how often can you get them done, and then how do you use them, or anything like that kind of a feedback mechanism. So we're looking at a lot of different things to get to your answer. And one of the things that we might be able to do in the interim is not tie our performance evaluations to annual reports and change of command timing. That's what I think gets in the way often of some of our, especially for our junior officers, any stage along the way, they often get frustrated with the fact that their timing was off for whatever reason. And COs then have to make some really tough choices, which they're paid to do, of course. But it does add another level of uncertainty and unfairness to some. And so you could ask, Why don't we just do more frequent evaluations, but don't tie them to change of commands and those sorts of things? So there are several good ideas out there. I'm not in the business right now of rewriting the performance evaluation itself, but it seems like about every 10 years we cycle on this one, and we're approaching that now. But we're gonna breathe through our nose on this one and study it thoroughly with whatever IT system we're able to put in place. How can we complement, how we do performance evaluations better, and then speed up the board process, speed up the selection process, and speed up several other aspects of our personnel system with a better IT system. Over.
Pulling the a little more up close and personal, so to speak, what type of secondary effects from a personnel point of view are we seeing from the 9 and 8 month deployments? And how do you see this new normal impacting, whether it's retention or training or career paths of our sailors?
Yeah, you know, from the macro standpoint, our retention numbers, I just reviewed our most recent report over the weekend. And once again, we're exceeding our Zone A, B, and C requirements, so retention is very good. We're seeing retention in almost all of our officer communities in a very good category. There are a couple that we have concerns about. I've talked about those in the past, and that continues to be an area, like with pilots and the anticipation that we're starting to see the beginnings of a airline hiring boom is probably the best way to term it. Those projections are about 20,000 pilots over the next 10 years. Whether that comes to realization or not, it's hard to tell. We've all lived through those before. But I am worried that we're going to swing behind that pitch if we don't get it right. We're seeing some retention issues with EOD and SEAL. As you might imagine, those two communities and that workforce has been run hard for the last 13, 14 years. And so their community leadership is talking with me and what can we do differently about them. The nuke fields are always challenging. There's just high demand for both their training, education, and specialties out on the civilian market. But outside of that, we're doing better than I think most people would expect, given the fact that we've had 4 or 5 years now of declining unemployment rates, which at some point is going to start affecting our ability to recruit and retain people. But right now, it's not. So I'm, which makes me even more anxious to get to a system that allows me to predict and project and forecast more accurately than we can today. Otherwise, we might do what Sal mentioned, which is swing behind this pitch.
When we talk about personnel evaluations, this is kind of a touchy subject, I'm sure, but some leaders get identified down the road as toxic leaders, and I know that's one of the things that the 360 evaluation is supposed to help address. Is there any system discussion about how we identify people who may be outstanding naval officers except for the fact that their leadership style seems to be poisonous to those who serve with them?
Yeah, Eagle One, they are so, at least in my experience in the last 21 months in this job, and then of course being out in the fleet and various other jobs, it's a leadership, I would say it's a leadership challenge for leaders above that level, wherever that toxic leader is, to be dealt with as soon as it comes up. I've often talked to the Command Leadership School about being willing to confront when you need to confront at the time you see something. Many of us wait, and I'm guilty of this. I when I was a young commanding officer, I had opportunities to confront leadership issues and challenges, and I waited for more information to come in before I acted. And I don't mean confrontation to sound like a negative word. It's a way to go after potential problems and nip it in the bud before it becomes a bigger problem. And I think a lot of those folks that end up becoming identified as toxic leaders are allowed to continue before somebody confronts them, and we don't catch it early enough. So you would hope that some of this 360 evaluation material is helping there, but it's not broad enough. We're not doing it with enough people to catch it early as an O3 or an O4 or an E5 or an E6 to prevent it from before that leader becomes a more senior leader. So you got to be comfortable confronting people, and sometimes that's a learned skill, and sometimes people are pretty natural at it. For me, it was a learned skill, and now I don't wait for too many lines of bearing. I generally like two, and then I'm good. But one line of bearing is often you may be jumping too soon. But I think the more we mentor and coach leaders at all levels about how to deal with toxic leadership or toxic personalities, I think the better we're going to get as a Navy. And by the way, this is such a small percentage of the leaders out there. I got a lot of confidence in the leaders we've got at every level today.
We're approaching 15 years since 9/11, and since then, in the long war that we've been working with, we've seen a large use of various flavors of Naval Reserve. I know the Army especially, and to a lesser extent the Air Force, have really tapped in even to the individual ready reserve to get people to fill positions and to help flesh out support and staff and even frontline forces. From the Navy point of view, when you look at how we are utilizing our reserves and our personnel policy towards reserves, what are some of those things that come to mind that may be lessons that we've identified on things that perhaps we should restructure our reserves towards, or things that we should move our reserve policy in a more supportive way so we can better utilize them in similar ways that the Army has, perhaps?
Yeah, boy, it's a really important question. And when I was growing up as a junior officer, the reserve force had lots of structure and lots of opportunities for reservists to be together in command and units all over the country. They had their own planes. In some cases, they might have even had their own ship. But there were a lot of units we over time have not been able to afford to continue to recap the reserves, but the reserves over the last 14 years have come in hard and strong when it came to supporting our forces in this fight in Iraq, Afghanistan, all over the world. To a very large extent, the vast majority of all those IAs out there have been covered by reservists who've done a marvelous job, and so I think we are in a transition, Sal. I feel like because the pressure on recapitalization, that more and more of those what were formerly reserve units are now disappearing, but the value of reserve talent is growing, and we need to be able to bring reservists in at the individual level and supplement, augment, and enhance our active forces, much the way maybe you remember Mao's and Sal's did when I was a JO. Those guys were invaluable when they came in to help train. They brought experience levels that you couldn't find in many cases. They've helped us transition many platforms over the last few years with their expertise. In my own community, the P3 to P8 transition could not have been done without the reservists that had 737 experience and other types of experience to help us to make that transition in Jacksonville, for example. So I think we are transforming that relationship in the Navy, even though there are still some incredibly valuable reserve units out there that deploy security forces, special forces, and a variety of other capabilities out there in whole units. But that whole unit concept is slowly declining, and I think the active force finds a lot greater value in the individual augmentation of our active force to help make them better, and I want to see more opportunity for active forces to be able to go to reserves for some period of time and come back on active duty in a much more transparent and free-flowing manner. And a lot of reserve sailors today who are looking to come back on active duty, I want to make sure we give them that opportunity. It's going to reduce our training costs. It's going to reduce our recruiting requirements, and it's going to continue to enhance, I think, the connection we have between the military and the rest of civil society, which is another topic for another day, but it's an important one. Over.
Well, as a reserve officer, I appreciate those comments. I think that the reserves have proved exceptionally valuable. Admiral, I don't think we've given you the chance to do this before. I'm going to open it up. Is there some topic that we didn't touch on today that you would you really think ought to be addressed that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I could cover lots of different things, Eagle One, and I really do appreciate the time. I think one of the more startling statistics that I see in this job is the, and I see it up close and personal every time I go out to Great Lakes and become a reviewing officer at one of those graduations. And if you never had the opportunity to do that, any American citizen, active reserve, or just a regular civilian in American society should go see these events, whether it's Navy or down in Paris Island or Marine Corps. But what happens is these young men and women graduate after 8 weeks of boot camp, and their parents and relatives all come to town, and they stand and they sit in this large building, this auditorium where they do a formal graduation. And every time I've gone to one, I just ask all the veterans in the crowd to please stand and be recognized. And the vast majority of folks that are in that crowd stand up. So what that tells you is the statistics across DOD are about 82% of the young men and women who sign up, swear allegiance to the Constitution every year, are coming from military bloodlines. So we've heard folks like Dave Petraeus and Jim Mattis and others say less than 1% of our society is participating in our military service today. Is largely that 1% is coming from our sons and daughters, nieces and nephews, grandkids, granddaughters, grandsons. What does that tell us about the society or the profession that we have? Are we closing ourselves off from the rest of American society, and what can we do about that? Should we do anything about that? I mean, the kids we have today are incredible quality, so you could argue that we can do just fine with that ratio. But I think it's a dangerous path that we're on, that over time that all-volunteer force becomes an all-volunteer force of military bloodlines. And we become a caste society of just folks that have grown up in this business. I do worry about it. I think we've got to open the aperture for the rest of American society, because eventually American society will grow more tired than they already are of the war footing we've been on, and they'll be less willing to pay for the military we have, and that will come in the form of pay and compensation, and it'll come in the form of the stuff we need to continue to advance and be superior to any other adversary in the world. So I guess that's where I would close it. We've got to do more outreach. We've got to do more awareness to the American public and try to inspire more young Americans that are not military bloodlines and join our team. Thank you very much.
Well, Moran, I really appreciate you taking a full hour out of your busy week to spend time with us. Lots of great information, and greatly appreciate the opportunity to hopefully expand the conversation on what is a very personal nature, and that's personnel policy in our neighborhood.
Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it. It's been an honor to be with you today.
Thank you very much, Admiral.
Yes, sir, and thank you, everybody, for joining us as well today. Please make sure and join us next week, where our guest will be Andrew DeGrandpre, and he will be on to discuss his expose he did last month on Task Force Violet. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.